Next speaker is Ruth Yane from ESF Syracuse.
The title that I supplied with my abstract was the first one. Will biomass harvesting of northern hardwood forests lead to nutrient depletion in the northeastern U.S.? And this is a study that I am personally involved in. One of my collaborators, Steve Hamburg, was involved in this other study led by Charlie Canham, and he suggested that I add Charlie as an author. And this is a question of what is the potential for increased biomass production in the northeast region? And Charlie Canham says, not much. So I'm going to start with that aspect of the talk. I'm going to stop after that and ask for discussion, because I'm interested in your feedback on that, and then I'll proceed to my original topic. How do I progress?
Arrow. Just
click. 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 Ah. Okay, so in New England, we need heat. I've been thinking about that while I'm in Texas. Wood is good at heat. So we do use wood for heat already in New England or the Northeast. There's also quite a lot of small wood to electricity power plants in the Northeast. And it seems like there should be a lot of potential here because, as Rob said, in the Pacific Northwest, there's a lot of biomass that's not removed when we harvest for timber. So what's the potential to be using that energy or to increase our harvest rates in the northeastern U.S. Okay, so Charlie calls his presentation myth busting, and these are the myths, and I admit I believed in some of these myths. Okay, so the northeastern U.S. was cleared for agriculture and was abandoned when the Ohio Valley became available, right? So we're talking about 100 years ago. We have forests regenerating since agricultural abandonment or since clear cutting that was, say, 100 years ago. So if that were the case, we have northeastern forests that are even aged and mature, and we would have more productivity if we cut these mature forests and replace them with younger agrading forests. I think I had that in my abstract, and Charlie Canham said that is not true. So what we're all excited about is the idea that there's this huge untapped resource and the potential to increase sustainable biomass production from our region. All right, so where Charlie's getting his myth-busting from is FIA data. So most of you are probably familiar with this resource. There's lots, 18,000 sample points in our region, and they get sampled about every 5 years. So a lot of where he's coming from is comparing the most recent sample to the previous sample. You should know that the most recent sample is about 2008, which is about the peak of, right, it's before the bust of. I was surprised, actually. Paul said 7 years, it hasn't been so great. So, you know, depending on what time period you make this comparison for, you'd get a different answer for what's the harvest rate from the region. So using these FIA across the whole region, we can ask how much forest is out there. The answer is about 67, two-thirds of the area is in forest. How much forest is there by state? There's a lot of forest. Some fraction of that is not available for cutting. So in New York, you can see the effect of the Adirondack Park and the Catskill Park. Any public lands within those areas can't be harvested. So that's a pretty big percentage. But in the region as a whole, there's about 6% that we can't include if we want to say how much biomass could we be getting from our forests. There's other limitations besides that, and some of the reasons people have come up with higher estimates for the potential for biomass is because they think every tree out there is available. So there's other problems that could be too wet to be logged, it could be too steep to be logged. Those add up to more than the reserved area. And then what if it's just so far from a road that it's not economical to get the wood out? And in this study, he used greater than 1 mile as being possibly not available. Then there's not large ownerships anymore, but certainly not controlled by the timber companies or paper companies. There's smaller and smaller ownerships. At some point, it's so small that it's not worthy of a harvest operation. And then who are the people who are making decisions about whether those private, non-industrial properties are being logged? So these all factor into what you decide, what you want to estimate for what's available. How about this one? Forests of the region are regrowing and they're even aged and mature. This is one of Charlie's photos flying around in small airplanes. You don't see a lot of clear cuts. And if you look at the FIA biomass estimates, you don't see a ton of... There's a lot of land area that has low biomass on it. So look at Maine. So at Hubbard Brook, we say 200 tons per hectare is a mature forest. And Maine is mostly under 100 tons per hectare. You can kind of see the Adirondack Park. You can see the Catskills. There's not a lot of these dark green dots that are at 200 or more tons per hectare. This is the frequency distribution of tons per hectare across the landscape by state. So you can see Maine has a lot of land area in these smaller biomass classes. Here's 200 out here, so not a lot is in what we would consider mature forest. There's differences by the region. And what about productivity? So if we don't have these over-mature 100-year-old even-age stands, Charlie made this graph of productivity as a function of the biomass of the plot. So out here is 200, here's 100, we're at about 100. The mode of these distributions is 100, lower for Maine. Somewhere in here, it looks like we're already pretty much at this, well, on the average in the region, we're at this sweet spot already for where you'd expect productivity to be highest. We can evaluate whether clear cutting is happening in our region. So all of our talks and the long-term historical studies that Dale told us about, we've been thinking of clear cutting as being our harvesting system. If we look at FIA data, you can tell whether trees are removed because you see stumps, and you can analyze what's the probability that a plot was logged between these two inventories? And then if it was logged, what fraction of the basal area has been removed? So this is the probability of logging, and you can see, again, that Maine is cutting at a much higher rate than the rest of the region. And then if you just take the ones that were logged during that time period, the average harvest removal is probably 30% for the region. Again, you can see that not only is Maine cutting more of the area, but they're removing more material from the area that they cut. But clearly, clear cutting is not the dominant management practice. Oh, he also has data on which species are being cut. And there's a lot of low-value species being cut, so... I'm interested in, is Dan Richter going to tell us about whether we're seeing sustainable forestry practices? I'd be interested to hear analysis of that, too. So what does it add up to in the region? So this is comparing the two inventories, the previous census to the current census. There's not a huge amount of net growth going on. There's two regions in which there was less in the most recent census to the previous census. All right, Maine is one of them. Connecticut is the other. Rhode Island has the biggest increase in biomass, but that's the smallest state. So we add this up. This is the this is growth. We want to subtract mortality. This is really interesting. So the logging removals in most cases are greater than the mortality. So this is important to describe understanding dynamics in our forests. It's partial harvests, and they exceed the losses due to mortality. And then, so net growth minus removals, how does that compare to what we have? In Maine, it's more than what we have. Connecticut is close. There is, in the region overall, definitely the potential to be using, the harvest rate could be higher. So we're not totally maxed out on sustainable removals. And again, this was a period of high removals, perhaps. So they analyzed three scenarios. A lot of this harvesting is going to pulp and paper. So if that went to biomass energy, what would we get? Maybe that's certainly not carbon neutral, right? Because then we're going to get our pulp and paper from somewhere else, but maybe there's better places to get those from. Then the interesting question to me is, what's the potential for harvesting areas that aren't currently being harvested? And for that, you have to make a bunch of assumptions. One of them is, we're not going to start taking saw logs and using them for energy. So that's true to all these scenarios. And then you have to try to guess what the restrictions are in available land. So if it's too wet, if it's too steep, what are the parcelization effects? And what they did was carry through a high and a low estimate for each of those assumptions. So starting with the total for growth, we subtract out mortality. Out of the net growth, here's the amount that's currently being removed and used. And scenario A, we're going to say we could burn this. Scenario B, we're looking at what fraction of that is not being removed from the woods, and then how much of this part that's not being harvested now is actually available to be harvested. And we're not going to say we're going to burn. If we cut that, we're not going to say that the saw logs are going to go to energy. So then we're looking at how much there is for energy. So scenario A says nothing's going to the paper mill anymore. Scenario B, can we cut more? Scenario C, how about both? If we burned everything that's going to paper now and took all the new harvests, and these are the totals in tons per year that we could expect from the region. So paper is big. Paper is bigger than what we could get from additional harvests now. So if we say we could burn all the paper, that's where we get most of the energy from. Then converting this to what would that be out of our energy mix, we're talking 2% of the total. So, and then to compare this to what some of the high-end estimates have been, Tim Volk, who's a colleague of mine in the forestry department for New York, came up with, wrong slide. So New York, he said 5 million tons per year, and that's a lot higher than these are, and that depends. I think that was based on higher productivity rates and data that showed a lower current harvest. All right, and Massachusetts had come out with estimates of 100,000 tons, and so these estimates are lower than that, and that they didn't assume that there was a lot of area that couldn't be used. So you can get higher and lower numbers depending on what you put into these assumptions. Oops, I don't know how to click through. Okay, so yes, there's a lot of forest land in the U.S., in the northeastern U.S. It's being heavily used already. It's not true that we would have higher productivity by increasing the harvest rate. There are important assumptions in these analyses about how much of the forest land is available for harvest and what's going to happen to the harvested material. And then, of course, we don't know whether the current level of productivity is sustained in future rotations or under future conditions. Here's some other comments from Charlie, and I think these are interesting to all of us. Certainly this idea of even-aged management is maybe not relevant to my region. What is stand age? And then do we get unrealistic estimates of productivity when we study experimental forests and then scale them up to the whole landscape? FIA is not biased that way. So what we choose for a good representative site, is that really representative? And then do we need to think about logging as one of our ecological processes describing forest productivity or behavior in our landscape? It's actually greater than mortality is, according to the FIA data. So if you have questions, I want to refer you to Charlie's report. But I do want to stop now and hear discussion on this topic, and I will attempt to answer questions about this piece of my presentation. Thank you. Yeah, Dale.
I'm an old man, and I'm confused. It looked like your biomass was peaked at 100, right? 100 years old.
Whoops, wrong way.
And yet he says that when you cut and regrow, you can't increase production.
Well, you know, he said, how come nobody has made a graph like this before? And we are not familiar with this graph. So this is the graph Dale's asking about. Sorry. Wait, this one. Okay, so this is biomass increment. So clear, this is biomass. So we have stands out here. They have higher biomass. So these stands out here have higher biomass
and lower increment.
And lower increment.
The trees, you'd have higher increment, right?
So if we cut these stands, it is absolutely true that we would have higher increment. No, the question is, if our region as a whole, if we cut back, if we removed biomass from our region as a whole, would we be pushing back into this even lower range where we have lower increment? So our region as a whole has this distribution already peaking around 100. And this distribution peaks, well, maybe it's a little higher than 100. Maybe we needed to grow more before it would be at the peak of productivity. Yeah, so this part's not surprising. The surprising part is that if we thought this curve was out here more, then we would say, yeah, it's going to be great. We're going to cut back and we'll be more over here. But we're already over here.
But you've also got a density thing here. And so, you know, are all your forests fully stocked? That's the biggest impact we've had, is to plant our forests and fully stock them. So it is an age. It's also whether or not the site's occupied. It seems to me like a lot of New England forests have relatively low stocking.
Well, and maybe they have relatively low stocking because
just by going to higher stocking at any age.
Except that we're cutting them on this. Wait, am I going backwards? We're cutting them. We are using partial cutting. There's parts of New England where you're not allowed to clear cut. So some of it's public.
But that's not an issue of productivity. That's a construct. We don't log on federal land either. That's a construct.
But, right.
It seems to me like, Ruth, you're saying this, but it isn't really what you're saying that's the issue. It's the if you have a forest that has a relatively low stocking, that'll come across as a younger forest in the way you're analyzing it, right?
Yeah, well, younger doesn't really work now, right? So what if we have is a bunch of big trees and we took out half of them at the last entry? Then what does that model look like for what productivity is going to be? I don't know to what degree we need different models now to describe what productivity, how to describe productivity with forest management. I'm going to go on. So if you have more questions, save. Oops, I keep clicking the wrong way. Okay, so this is the part that involves a research project in New Hampshire where we want to look at the sustainability of forest biomass harvesting. So it's fine to say that, yes, we're getting this many tons per hectare. Can we keep doing that? What are the impending limits for nutrient supply? So this is the old question Dale's told us about. For a long time, we've been looking at this question of what's the rate of nutrient removal or loss with harvesting, and can the soil supply them? So there were simple budgetary approaches to this question. This is the fraction of the biomass that's in wood. So this is assuming a 5-inch definition of what's timber. There's a smaller fraction of the total biomass that we could get with more intensive removals. It's not a smaller fraction in terms of nutrients. So other speakers have said this. The wood is a great way to make carbon at low nutrient concentration, and all the other parts have higher nutrient concentrations. This is for phosphorus. This is for calcium. We're talking about removing a bigger fraction of the nutrient stocks than of the carbon stocks. So we wanted to just ask, how does the nutrient content of the vegetation compared to the soils, how many rotations can we remove? The answer is going to depend on, the answer is going to be limited by the most limiting nutrient. And we can do this for stands in which we have quantitative soil pits with great detail on the nutrient pools. And then three scenarios for removals. Mature, say 100 years old, with or without the extraction of the rest of the non-timber biomass, versus a 30-year rotation, cut everything down. This would be our short rotation intensive culture. And we assume atmospheric inputs based on the Hubbard Brook record, which I said has a lot of nitrogen in it. These are the sites. So some of these are Tony Federer's chronosequence, where I became interested in the question of calcium supply in young stands. Bartlett, where we now have experimental treatments, adding nitrogen, phosphorus, both, neither. And as of last week, we have some calcium additions. And these are Steve Hamburg's former ag sites. So the quantitative soil pits, some of you are intimately familiar with this process. We sample down into the sea horizon. And so here's a phosphorus budget, assuming that all of the organic and extractable phosphorus is available and zero leaching or occlusion of available phosphorus. So we're taking the soil stock and dividing by the amount that we remove and the amounts we lose for a rotation time and getting the number of rotations. So here's our soil pool for phosphorus at one of our sites. Here's the wood, and here's the boles, and here's the rest of the woody biomass. So if we remove all of this, there's some left behind us. Slash, we start here. We're getting a tiny, tiny bit coming in from rain. And then as the forest regrows, we're just subtracting that from the soil pool. So we cut it again, and we're going to be gone in 2.5 rotations. And that's assuming that productivity is sustained. So we can do that for each element, see which one runs out first. We can do it for all three of our harvest scenarios and for our 14 sites. And here's our, I wanted to know, how do these, if we assume a 100-year scenario and this is our removal rate, how does that compare to what Charlie says is growing across the landscape based on FIA? And it looks fine. Look, we're in New Hampshire, 1.87. He says New Hampshire, 1.83. So now I'm not worried that our experimental forest is not representative of my region. This is a very high rate, and that's not the way anything is being managed currently. So here's the answer. The answer is it's never nitrogen that runs out. It's usually calcium or phosphorus. It's going to run out in like 100 years if we think we can do this intensive culture thing, you know, in a few hundred years if not. For 100 years, you get a long time. 100-year rotation and take the timber out only, we don't have a lot to worry about. Here's the same results presented in terms of how much biomass you get out. So if you're more conservative with taking nutrients out with your wood or waiting longer, you can get more biomass in the long run. And then we know the forest is growing back, and it wouldn't if it had only the exchangeable pool to grow from. So this is what Dale said. I've been interested in the importance of long-term weathering rates. Don't look like they explain it, but it sure looks like there's enough weathering going on now. So in our earlier comparison, that paper Dale showed a slide of, I should have had slides in here, looking at stands of different ages, there is more calcium going around in young stands. I thought, oh, is that because they're phosphorus limited and they're weathering appetite? So our sequential extraction has this special step done at 10 degrees centigrade to minimize the dissolution of other elements, one normal nitric acid, after we do an exchangeable or a peroxide digestion, and we call that the appetite pool. So in these scenarios, we say, let's assume that they can weather appetite, and we can give them appetite through the entire soil profile or even into the sea horizon. How much difference does that make? So now we get more than 100 years in all cases. We get huge variations across sites, but, you know, it's not an infinite resource. So even with Tony Federer's analysis of let's weather everything that's less than 2 millimeters, You know, there's going to, looks like we have some issues. We don't know these are till source wedges. So Scott Bailey developed this analysis. We know what direction the glaciers moved in from striations. We know how far they moved material from erratic. So you can kind of say for each of our soil pits, where's the possible sources of parent material? Unfortunately, we don't know the phosphorus concentrations in these parent materials, but you can see why there would be variation from site to site in what would be a sustainable removal or a number of rotations to depletion. Okay, so conclusions from this second analysis, there's a lot of variation from site to site. Some of that is not just the parent material source, but also the soil mass differs a lot from site to site. We know weathering rates must be important, and the degree to which forests can accelerate weathering under different conditions of nutrient limitation is one of my current research interests. You know, maybe 100 years from now, we're going to be in a new world of new energy regimes, and maybe 100 years is enough for us to be taking use of this resource to help us get to the next step. Thanks very much. So I hope we have time for some more questions. Rob?
I just have a question about, it's great that you sample as deeply as you did, but I remember when I was in New Hampshire in the Kingman Farm, there was a study that had gone on for about 30 years with alfalfa. They applied everything but potassium, cropped it heavily, and did this for decades. And the theory was that they would deplete potassium. And they did. There wasn't any potassium exchangeable in the top meter, but the alfalfa never stopped growing at a high rate. So we excavated and followed the alfalfa roots down. We stopped at 16 feet. There was lots of exchangeable potassium at 16 feet. There was none in the top meter. So do you think...
Did you find any roots down there?
Oh, absolutely. A few. But is there the possibility that your trees might tap below the depths to which you're analyzing?
Well, we'll be excited if we can show that they're getting it out of the sea horizon. So, and Joel Bloom is planning to do rare earth elements. You know, we can do ingrowth cores for roots. And then we're doing these nitrogen-phosphorus additions. So if we can, by adding nitrogen, increase the demand for phosphorus, then that's where we would expect to see weathering going on. So I don't know. We haven't dug down to 16 feet. It's hard enough to dig a pit like this.
I know. It was just amazing what alfalfa did and how it found that potassium somewhere.
This wasn't through basal till, though. I mean, what were you using?
No. There was basal till nearby, but this wasn't on a basal till site.
We do find roots. We find roots down in the sea horizon. It's not a lot of them, but they are getting roots down there.
Let's not forget about the rocky and black horizon, too.
Yep. Yeah, we'll be looking for those.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
The break.